So I guess I'm introducing myself. I don't see anybody else here to do it. My name is Michael Novick. I am with a group in Los Angeles called People Against Racist Terror, PART. We picked the name with the slogan, Be Part of the Solution. We're an aspect of the Anti-Racist Action Network, ARA. And I was asked to speak on the theme today of organizing for mass mobilizations versus community organizing, something like that. Community building, okay. And that was based on an editorial that was in the issue of the paper I just passed out. But I actually want to take a couple of steps back from that theme, so I will get to it, but I think there are some prior things to establish first, and I'm coming. I guess I should say that there was supposed to be another panelist, and he decided not to participate based on the fact that someone was excluded for alleged sexual assault, and he felt he couldn't participate. So I'm the only one speaking today on this theme. I'm going to change what I say a little bit based on my experience at the conference this weekend. And I put this quote up here from a woman named Marge Piercy. I don't know if anybody's ever read any of her books, but she is from my generation. She was an activist in the 60s and wrote a number of very interesting kind of science fiction and other books speculating about possible futures. And one of the things she said was, if what we change does not change us, we are playing with blocks. And I think it's important to understand that we need to be engaged in our process of change at all times. I teach school in Los Angeles. I teach adult education, English as a second language. And I ask my students really to evaluate me every day and to evaluate themselves and to consider, you know, based on their participation in class today, do they speak English better? Do they understand more English? Can they express what they need better? Can they ask more questions and get more answers and do more things and communicate more with people they need to talk to and, you know, get what they need from the parents, the teachers of their children or the bus driver, whatever it is. And I think that we need to be asking ourselves those kinds of questions all the time. In fact, is what we're doing efficacious for us? And are we getting somewhere? And I feel like I've gotten a lot out of this conference, but it's going to be reflected, actually, in what I say today, the process and the struggles that I feel like we're engaged in here. So before we talk about this question of, you know, community building or community organizing versus mass mobilizations, I think we need to, as I say, step back a little bit and look at what the content of the mobilizations are, what the content of the community organizing is, what communities we're organizing in. You know, it's self-evident from the makeup of this conference, and there's been a lot of discussion in many of the different workshops I've been in about the fact that this is a predominantly conference of young white people. And obviously, if we want to really change society, we have to be engaged with a lot more than that. But you know, you're an important component of any transformation of this society. You have to be engaged in it, and we have to understand how to do that. So if we're going to go out and do community organizing, well, what community are we going to organize? What community are we going to build? If we're going to go out and protest, what are we protesting about? What are we protesting for? So there are a few points up there. I don't know if you can see them that clearly. I put them up on the board, but there are a few themes. I was part of a movement like your movement. You know, it's a while back now, but in 1967, let me say a little bit more about myself before that. I grew up as an Orthodox Jew. I went to yeshiva through high school. I was a sissy growing up. I had a very strong sense that I was, you know, not enough of a man and needed to do something to be more of a man. All of these were anxieties that shaped how I became political. And I went to Brooklyn College, which was a free public four-year college in Brooklyn, tax-supported, for a couple of reasons, three reasons related to you know, who I was. One was that I could not get into Columbia because I was poor and working class. Two was I did not want to go to Yeshiva University because I was an atheist, and I was afraid that if I continued at all-boys schools, I would become gay, which, in fact, I lived as a gay man for a number of years later on. And three was that I could live at home and take the bus to college. and it was free. So I went there, and for me it was a tremendously liberating experience because it was the first time I was in any group of people that were not 100% Orthodox Jews. And it was about 85% Jewish, but a lot of them weren't Orthodox. And there were actually some Catholics. And it was the 60s, and I got involved in all the struggles that you would get involved in. We had a sit-in for a teacher who was fired for, or refused tenure, as they said, for not towing the right line in the literature department and, you know, being too much of a Marxist. And we got involved with struggles for student rights and student power and civil rights and anti-war and so on. And in 1967, through those struggles, I was actually elected student body president at Brooklyn College. And we went to the National Student Association Congress. I don't know if people know the National Student Association, but it was being run, we had just found out, by the Central Intelligence Agency. They had co-opted the main organization of students in the United States for the purposes of international espionage and spying on the students in other countries and keeping a lid on student activity in this country. And so SDS ran a counter convention to the National Student Association, and I, you know, learned a lot more about the world and was radicalized further by that. I was radicalized by involvement in the anti-war movement. When we came back to campus, we did a student evaluation of teachers' handbook. The administration had promised that they would, you know, fund it, and they reneged on their promise. And so we did the survey ourselves. We published it ourselves. We distributed it ourselves without, you know, official approval from the school. The next month, the state legislature did some budget cuts, and the school announced they were going to close the library on the campus at night. And we said, well, you can't do that because the students who come at night are the working class and poor students who can't afford to go to the school during the day. They're in what's called the School of General Studies. If you close the library, they have no place to study, no place to do homework, no place to prepare for their classes. And so we had a sit-in. We had hundreds of students from the day school said, we're in solidarity with the students in the night school, and we're not going to let you close the library. And, you know, in about 2 minutes, a couple of state legislators came down and said, oh, no, we'll pass an emergency appropriation bill, and they did. They gave us more money. They kept the library open. The Navy came to recruit on campus, and at that time the campus, I should say, the fact that I was elected, they did not have a student government in that campus for 15 years. The last student body president before me had opposed the Korean War, and they abolished the student government. They were not going to, the students did not vote for anybody for 15 years, so it was a big victory even to have a campus election. There were two places on the campus where you could distribute literature at that time, which were two tables in the hall of the administration building. And so the fraternities had one table, and the Navy had the other table recruiting people to join the Navy. And so SDS said, well, that's not fair. We want to give people the other side of the message, at least. They weren't trying to stop the Navy from recruiting. It was just like, we want to have a table, too. So they just brought a card table and set it up to pass out literature. And the assistant dean of students came and told them, no, you can't do that. It's illegal. We have rules about where and when you can distribute literature. And they refused to leave. They were suspended when they refused to leave again. They were expelled when they still refused to leave. They called the cops, pulled them down the stairs by their hair, arrested them. We had a giant, student strike for 4 or 5 days. We closed the school down. We got the dean of students fired. So we were in motion. There was a lot going on. It was the 60s, you know. And then we looked around us, and we were in the city of New York. We were in the borough of Brooklyn. At that time, it was at least 40 or 50% black and Hispanic, Puerto Rican, then more Dominicans now, and, you know, West Indians. But then it was blacks and Puerto Ricans. And they were not going to Brooklyn College. There were, I don't know, I think 25 high schools in Brooklyn, and the entire population of Brooklyn College came from four of them. They came from the white high schools, the middle-class high schools. And so we said, well, this isn't right. We need to have open admissions. This is, you know, University of Michigan has open admissions. If you live in Michigan and you graduate high school, you get a shot at going to college in Michigan. If you live in New York and you graduate high school in New York, why don't you have a shot at going to college in New York? And what happened when we raised that demand for open admissions and actually a special admissions program for that immediate summer of people who had, you know, previously had no chance, black and Puerto Rican students, to get in, was that all of our student support base among the white students on the campus evaporated overnight, disappeared. And the arguments that you hear today about affirmative action were the arguments those students were making to us as the campus radicals, or the student body president in my case, that if we allowed black and Puerto Rican students into Brooklyn College, it would diminish the value of a Brooklyn College diploma. They would not get what they had bargained for when they went out in the world and said, I went to Brooklyn College, and you know what that is worth. That was their entry into, you know, success, a career track, and they were afraid that allowing blacks and Puerto Ricans in would diminish their investment in their own education, that their brothers and sisters would not have the guaranteed spot in that school. And so this was an object lesson to me and has really shaped my political life ever since of two things. One is that if you're engaged in any kind of struggle for social change, radical transformation of society, if you're trying to deal with any of the oppressive institutions, if you are not immediately and directly and consciously confronting racism in our society as it functions among the people who are engaged in the struggle, that you are building a house of cards, you're building a house of sand, and it's going to collapse at the first real opposition or the first challenge or the first division that appears that gives people the chance to make a choice about where am I really at in this struggle. And so I tell the story to explain why I am here and still struggling, because I am still struggling, and I'm in my 50s, and I have kids in college now. But to me, the choices I made then were lifelong choices. And so we had a sit-in at the end of my senior year, and I was expelled for demanding open admission, special admissions. I was arrested. I was eventually readmitted on suspension. Struggles went on. The black students the following year, the BSU, they brought massive conspiracy charges against the black and Puerto Rican students on the campus. They arrested people in the middle of the night out of their homes on incredibly ridiculous, you know, felony conspiracy charges. But in the face of all that repression, in fact, they did change the admission policies for the City University of New York, and that struggle was won. They did open up the admissions. Brooklyn College today, rather than having 10,000 students, has about 15 to 18,000, and they're half black and Puerto Rican. Not only that, but when they did adopt open admission policies, who else got into the college who had never been allowed in were working class Irish and Italian young people in New York who had owed their education to the fact that there was a black-led struggle for open admissions. Yet and still, a lot of those young white people were committed to their racist conceptions of who they were, and I include the young white Jews that I was part of, because the people who other people who politicized with me in that period of time were politicized into the Jewish Defense League. They went off to fight in Israel for against the Palestinians. They carried out physical violence against black students on the campus and against progressives. So, and you saw the same thing in working class communities in New York, that even though white working people were benefiting from the struggles of black and Puerto Rican people, without engaging in those struggles, they still felt vested in the system of white supremacy we've been talking about. So I think that it's essential that we look at these issues and how they play out today and how they play out here and how they play out in the future, because we cannot afford to have another generation go down the tubes as my generation pretty much has done. And when you think about what your commitment is and where we're going and what we're doing, what the strategies are, think about being 30, being 40, being 50, and what world you'll be living in and what your commitments will be, and how the world will be different, how you will be different and changed by your participation in this struggle. People, there was a seminar earlier on challenging white supremacy, and people talked about privilege and so on. And there was a lot of denial. I heard a lot of denial. People talked about class, this and that. But I've been through the mill, and I've seen it happen. And I'm not saying this to diss you or to insult you, but I know from experience that the vast majority of young white leftists who get involved in the movement make a calculation. There's a calculus that goes on, and I saw it happen. And the calculus is, how much of my privilege can I spend without losing my privilege? How far will I go before I retreat? What can I, you know, afford to give up without giving everything up, without breaking my ties to the system, without leaving that little trap door? I don't know how many people who are programmers now, whatever, you know, but there's always a little back door in the program, a little way to get back in. And people do that. They have their little program of struggle, but they're also thinking about, you know, the picket fence and the rest of it somewhere down the line. And, you know, my generation looked garish, and I had hair down to my ass, and I had earrings and, you know, a lot of stuff. But It's not particularly evident now because my hair is falling out. But, you know, thousands of people did, you know. I mean, everybody remembers the hippies. And where are the hippies now? They became the me generation. You know, they're invested in all the stocks and all the corporations that you're talking about rule the world. So, you know, just think about it. I have some points here I want to point out, and we will come around to the question of, as I said, community organizing versus mobilizing. And I think it's very important to understand what is the problem, because there have been a lot of attempts at solutions, and, you know, we had an attempt at solution. Civil rights was an attempt at a solution. A lot of, you know, I deal all the time with the question of racism, and if you're going to solve the problem, you have to know what the problem is before you can even begin to address solving it. And so there are certain aspects of what the problems are that we face. Can people see this board over here? I don't know. It's, try to get some light on it. But essentially, it's a little mnemonic device here. Problems we face: colonialism, capitalism, criminalization, coercion, and co-optation. Five C's. And why do I put colonialism first? I think it's really important to understand that we live in an empire. If you think you live in a democracy or a republic, there's a big debate during the elections, you know, between the Republicans and the Democrats. We live in a republic or a democracy. Well, the fact is we live in an empire, and it's been an empire since day one. This is conquered land. This is territory that was stolen from indigenous people. And that doesn't mean it happened 200 years ago or 400 years ago. It's still being stolen from, you know, if I steal your wallet, and if I keep your wallet for 200 years, it's not my wallet. It's your wallet. I'm still stealing it. And we need to grasp that and understand what that means. We have to create a different relationship to the land and to the people whose land, you know, this is, or and it still is theirs. So colonialism is the construct. It's the reality. It's the bedrock. If we talk about the state, if we talk about capitalism, we have to understand that capitalism and the state grew out of this system of colonialism. Marx called it primitive accumulation. What was the primitive accumulation? They stole the land. They stole the resources of the indigenous people. In fact, they did it in Europe before they even got here. If you look at the European states, we talk sometimes about the nation state, but the European states, each one of them, are empires. What is the United Kingdom? The United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland now. I mean, at least half of Ireland got away. But, you know, Great Britain is England, Scotland, Wales. You know, you've seen these movies with, what's his name, Mel Gibson. You know, the Scots didn't really want, they're not English. They didn't speak English. You know, they didn't live English. They were conquered. The Irish, you know, have another language. They're not English. They're conquered. The Welsh have another language. They're conquered people. And that's true in France. If you look at France, the Bretons and the rest, you know, they created little empires. You know, and you got this history to some extent. They talk about the Holy Roman Empire was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire, except it was an empire. They modeled themselves on the Greek and Roman empires. That's what Western civilization is. When Gandhi says Western civilization, that would be a good idea. But that was Western civilization. Western civilization is Alexander the Great. It's the conquest of the world. You know, it's not like just Lex Luthor who wants to run the world. You know, that's the model of personhood, is the emperor. You know, Julius Caesar, July, and where July, you know, if you ever look at, I guess I teach English, you know, we talk with my students about the months of the year. September, seventh month. October, octopus, eighth month. November, ninth month. December, tenth month. Because the Roman Republic, everything was tens, you know, to them. It was 10 times 10 times 10, the decimal system. So why is the seventh month, the ninth month? Why is the tenth month, the twelfth month? Because Julius Caesar came along and said, I'm God on earth. I'm the emperor. I want a month for myself. So they created July, but they didn't want to change the rest of the months because they wanted to maintain that little consciousness of resistance to the empire. And then they killed Julius, in fact. But then Augustus came along and said, no, I'm the emperor. So they said, oh, you can have August, but we're still not changing September. It's still seven. So all of world history is this struggle about the empire and whether you're part of it or you're against it. And that's the civilization that's created us. And that's what they, you know, the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, you know, took these ideas and spread them out around the world. And so when we talk about deforestation, where was the first place that was deforested? Europe. Europe was deforested by, not the Europeans as a whole, not the indigenous people of Europe, not the Celtic and Germanic and matriarchal people of Europe who were the original people who lived there, but the emperors, the people who created little empires in Europe, deforested Europe. And then when they had nothing left and they had driven all the people off the land they lived on in a different way, they privatized the land. Now, you and I know, people say, privatize the water. You can't privatize the water. You know, privatize the air. How can we privatize the air? But we accept the idea that we have private property in land and that you can mark a land up and divide it up and put streets and flags on it. But that's the empire. That's the consciousness of the empire, and that's what they did. And they said, okay, this is Italy. And they had wars for, 30 years, 50 years, 100 years. What were all those wars in Europe? That was about the empires contending about who's going to control what. And when they carved it up to their satisfaction, more or less, they proceeded to go carve up the rest of the world in the same way. And that was the basis of the state. That was the basis of capitalism. Merchant capitalism was not the same thing as the current system of capitalism we live under, which was about expropriating the land, privatizing the commons, driving the people who live on the land. It's not just the Brazilian landless peasants who are being driven off the land. They drove all of Europe off the land. They drove everybody in this. They're doing it right now. They're driving people off the land in the United States. Black farmers under Bill Clinton, the Agriculture Department eliminated 95% of the black farmers with a stroke of the pen because they said to have an official farm, you must be producing commodities for sale in the market. And 95% of black farmers in the United States are engaged in survival farming. They're not engaged. They're not in the market. They don't produce commodities. They grow what they eat, and they eat what they grow. And so they vanished. Now, some of them are still there, but a lot of them were actually forced off the land. And so this is happening today. It's happening in Brazil. It's happening in this country. Why do we have the cities that we want to reorganize in? So these are the realities. That's why I say colonialism first. Capitalism, yes. What does capitalism do? Brilliant system. Brilliant system. What does it do? It engages you in your own oppression. And I think this is really important to understand. We talked a lot about privilege and how it blinds people to the oppression of others. But privilege blinds you to your own oppression. You're oppressed. They oppress the shit out of you. They flew me here on American Airlines. I got on the plane, said, okay, I'll, just read my book. And they said, oh, we're really sorry. There's no movie tonight. We're just going to show you some short subjects. So they showed something from 60 Minutes about 10,000 kids from England, quote-unquote war orphans, except they weren't orphans. They were just the kids of single mothers who couldn't afford to raise their kids for a while because England was devastated economically by the war. They took the kids. They put them in homes. And then Australia said, we have the white Australia policy. We're afraid of the Asian hordes. We have a white outpost here in Australia. We don't have enough white people. Ship us some white children. And England sent 10,000 white kids whose families were still in England, whose mostly mothers, and sent them to Australia, promising them they're going to be adopted and put in wonderful homes. And these 10,000 British subjects, loyal subjects of the crown, never got a passport from Australia, never got a passport from England, lived as stateless people for 50 years being exploited. They were put in institutions in Australia. They had to build the institutions that they grew up in. They were sexually abused, the boys and the girls both. 50 years later, this is coming out. Some of the parents, I was in tears halfway here on the plane. An 80-year-old woman met her daughter for the first time. Daughter was 53. Since she gave her up when she was, at the end of World War II. So, they don't care about you because you're white. They don't give a shit about you. They only want you to identify with them. They want you to identify as an oppressor with the oppressor and with your own oppression and eat shit the rest of your life. That's what privilege blinds you to. So that's the system we're in. And that's not to say that, there is a hierarchy of oppression. You are not colonized. You're the colonizer. I'm the colonizer. That's a fact. But we have to decolonize. We have an interest in decolonization. And if you're an environmentalist or you're an animal rights activist, what happened to the animals in North America? Why are there no more buffalo in North America? Why are there no more otter, seals? You learn this history. The colonizer came and killed them. the French, you remember Sacajawea and Pocahontas and all that stuff, you know, the indigenous people were co-opted into collaborating with a few settlers, hunters, trappers. You know, they turned nature into a commodity via the empire. How do they make commodities? Well, you know, everything is a commodity if you apply a dollar value to it. It's got a resale value. And so the otters and the seals and the beavers of Canada and North America became hats, you know, for the rising bourgeoisie of France and elsewhere. And the buffalo just rotted because they wanted to practice shooting bullets at them or something. You know, they wanted to destroy the basis of the life of the indigenous people who lived here. If you take over nature, if you destroy the habitat, it's not only the animals that become extinct, they tried to make the people extinct. They wanted to build the railroads. So that's not just a dead history. That's not over and done with. That's happening right now. It continues to happen. And it's our responsibility to deal with it, and it's to our advantage to deal with it. What are some of the commodities they still, you know, people learn about the triangular trade when you were growing up? Did anybody talk to you about that? What was the triangular trade? Anybody remember that from world history? Triangular trade, they were trading the slaves for the products of the slaves. They brought, you know, the triangle was Africa, the West Indies, and Massachusetts, and back over to England, you know what I mean? And just recently, the Hartford Courant, big newspaper in Hartford, Connecticut, apologized, and Aetna Insurance apologized for their profits from the slave trade. They said, oh, we're really sorry, we made a lot of money, you know, up until 1860, advertising slaves for sale. Made a lot of money insuring slave cargoes. We're really sorry about that. We really apologize, you know. But it's still going on. They didn't give any of the money back. They haven't paid any reparations to any of those people. They're sitting on that wealth. And so are we. You know, who built D.C.? Who built the Washington Monument and the Capitol and the White House? It was slaves. But the brilliance of capitalism is that it incorporates you into it. Where does all that power come from? Where does all that wealth come from? They're extracting it from you right now. They're extracting it from the slaves. They're extracting it from the colonies. They're extracting it from the working class in the colonizing countries. It's called exploitation. And it happens every minute of every day, and people buy into it. Your labor power, quote unquote, is a commodity. Your creative capacity is a commodity. You know, your ability to write a computer program is a commodity, right along with the rest of it. Now, slaves were the ultimate commodities. The entire person was a commodity. They were bought and sold. What does that mean? You know, but the rest of it, we're engaged. You know what I mean? We create their wealth. All their power comes from us, from the oppressed and the exploited, and from the privileged. And that's what you have to understand. When you look at this edifice, you know, the great and mighty, you know, we say the bigger they come, the harder they fall. And how do we bring them down? Well, we have an interest in bringing them down. You know, people talk about, again, the environment, monoculture. Have you heard the song, "There's an awful lot of coffee in Brazil"? Why is there an awful lot of coffee in Brazil? Do the Brazilians drink a lot of coffee? No, because there's a market. The Europeans drink a lot of coffee. Why do the Europeans drink a lot of coffee? They have to get up early and work in the factory all day. There's an awful lot of tobacco in Kentucky. Not because the people in Kentucky, you know, pass the peace pipe, but because this society, this system, you know, finds drugs to be a very useful commodity. You know, you deaden your own pain. You dope yourself up to work a little harder for them, and you forget, you know, how much it hurts to get up every morning. Cocaine. There's an awful lot of cocaine in Colombia. Why? Are they hooked on cocaine in Colombia? Well, some of them actually are now, but not basically. Basically, there's an awful lot of cocaine in Colombia because it's a super profitable commodity. Why did the British fight the opium wars? Were they trying to keep opium out of England? No, they were trying to force China to accept British opium grown in India, the jewel of the empire. So this is the world we live in. And it's not, you know, something didn't happen in 1945 and now the world is different. It's the same exact fucking world. What is globalization? You know, globalization is the export of capital. U.S. capital. What is capital? Capital is the wealth they extracted from the colonized and oppressed people, from the exploited people, from the workers. Capital is a social relationship. If they're exploiting that relationship, they're exploiting that exploitation, they're globalizing it. If you want to bring down the global empire, you have to start with the empire right here at home. This is an empire. There were oppressed and colonized people right inside. Some people might have gone to the Vieques presentation yesterday. Vieques is an island part of Puerto Rico in which the U.S. Navy is carrying out bombing, and they drop, quote-unquote, depleted uranium. You know, what is depleted uranium? What do they deplete? It's one of those newspeak words. Depleted uranium is the uranium that's left. It's just natural uranium. They take out the enriched uranium to make the atomic bomb. The only thing depleted about it is you can't make an atomic weapon from it. It won't, you know, carry out a chain reaction. But it's radioactive. It's totally radioactive. And so Gulf War syndrome of U.S. GIs, you know, working class people, black and white and otherwise, who went to fight Saddam Hussein, are suffering from radiation sickness called Gulf War syndrome from handling depleted uranium. And Kosovo, the Serbs and the Kosovars equally suffering from, you know, the toxic destruction of their environment by depleted uranium munitions. So this is a system that, you know, doesn't care about you or anybody else on the planet. They care about profit. They care about maintaining that empire. Last year, as far as the system, criminalization and criminality. Important to understand this. They can criminalize anything. They could criminalize us right now for being here. They certainly could criminalize you for walking down the street last week during the inauguration, the coronation, whatever you want to call it. You know, they criminalize people for smoking marijuana. They criminalize people for smoking tobacco if they want to. Anything that they can make money out of making it a crime, they want to criminalize. And they also want to produce a criminal mentality. It's fine with them if people are criminals. The criminal mentality is also a capitalist mentality. It's what's in it for me. You know, something for nothing. That's the essential capitalist mentality. So if we want to have a different mentality, it's got to be a revolutionary mentality, not a criminal one. But we do have to resist the criminalization of all these behaviors. In California, they criminalize work. If you're a quote-unquote illegal alien, what the hell does that mean, illegal? You know, it means you're undocumented. You have the right papers. It's a crime to work. It's not a crime to hire them, but it's a crime to do the work. It's a crime to stay on the street looking for work in California. They wanted to make it a crime to go to school if your parents had come to this country looking for work. And how do they maintain this? They maintain this in two ways. Very important to understand. Coercion and co-optation, and they work together. I do a lot of work about police brutality, and there was a discussion earlier about the reformism and the anti-police brutality movement in New York about how, no, the cops are really good. We need cops. But if you watch TV for 15 minutes, you know the good cop, bad cop is a strategy of the police, right? You know, Jimmy Smits and Andy Sipowicz, you know, they take turns. One week Andy's the good cop, and the next week Jimmy's the good cop, and vice versa. One's the bad cop. You know, because they want to break your resistance. They want to interrogate you more efficiently. They want to break it. The CIA wrote a manual about how to torture people. You don't torture people by just constantly torturing them. You torture them by torture them for a while, and then you give them a cigarette. You make friends. You know, you relieve the pressure. And so the good cop and the bad cop work hand in hand. It's the carrot and the stick. If all he did was hit you on the head, period, you'd say, well, fuck this. You know, but they don't. They hit you in the head for a little bit, then they give you a little carrot for a while, then they hit you in the head again. And after a while, you get confused, and you can't tell the difference. You know, and maybe you buy a hit on the head. Say, hey, that felt pretty good. I'm kind of dizzy now. So that's co-optation and coercion. You know, they work hand in hand. They use them, and they work very effectively together. But some people get more of the coercion. And if you're black in this society, the chances are that the police relate to you in a different way. And if you're white, it's different. There's more co-optation if you're white, a lot more. But it works for black people. It works for colonized people. They have neo-colonial people. They have the mayor of Los Angeles, who was black for a long time, didn't make any difference for black people. Mayor of D.C. was black, didn't make any difference. D.C. is still a colony. So what are the solutions? Is that this problem? What do we need? Here's my other mnemonic list. Begins all with S. Self-esteem. Say, why all that sissy stuff? Self-esteem, that's what they talk about. That's Tony Robbins. No, but What does self-esteem mean? That means that people who are shat upon need to understand that they can, they have the human, you know, Jesse Jackson said, I am somebody, you know, and people want to hear that, you know, because if society tells you you're nobody, you're nothing, you're worthless, you need to understand that you are the creative power. You have, you know, the spark of whatever, not divinity, but certainly dignity inside you, you know, where the wealth and the power comes from. And for women to say, that's right, my esteem is not dependent on a man's decision of me. I don't have to measure up to some ridiculous ideal of femininity or beauty or, you know, that's you know, that's part of revolutionary transformation. For black people to say, yes, I'm black and I'm proud. You know, I don't have to, my definition is not Hollywood or, you know, the WB. You know, if you don't think that self-esteem is important, why do you think that the police in L.A. and other cities are so dead set at destroying all the gang truces? Because if black people love themselves, they're not going to be killing themselves and each other. And then the police start to worry about where the rage that they do have is going to go if it's not self-destructive. Self-determination, very important. It's not just an individual struggle. It's got to be collective. People have to be able to meet together, to join together, and to determine our own future, our own destiny. And in particular, colonized and oppressed people must have the right and the ability to do that. So they're not here today, in the most part. I mean, they're off determining their own destiny in other ways. We have the responsibility as white people who are also have a stake in fighting this system. We need to understand that. It's not noblesse oblige. It's not the left version of the white man's burden, you know. You have to be fighting for your own future, for your own life, for your own liberation, where there's no point to this. But solidarity is vital. You know, people talk about white allies. What is an ally? When the United States had allies in World War II, that meant that they were, you know, the British had soldiers who were fighting and dying. The French, you know, had a clandestine resistance who were fighting and dying. You know, the Russians bore the brunt of it. That's what an ally is, somebody who's fighting, you know, for the same goal, the same purpose, the same cause, equally committed in it for the long haul, bringing something to the table. A white ally is not a few isolated individuals who say, oh, yeah, I want to be groovy and I want black people to think better of me. You know, you're not going to attach yourself to somebody else's struggle. You're not going to get brownie points for doing this. But you have to be in solidarity. You have to say, yes, your struggle is my struggle. I'm struggling for human liberation, and I need to understand that I am, you know, maybe one-tenth with my so-called racial identity of the human race. You know, it's true that there are a million black people in prison. It's also true there are a million white people in prison. And we need to do prison work organizing those white people to abandon white supremacy. The Aryan Brotherhood is in the prisons organizing those white people to be racist dogs. You look at those guys who killed James Byrd in Texas, three Aryan Brotherhood members. They went into prison. One of them, they said, oh, he was the sweetest guy. He never had a racist bone in his body. And he was organized by the Aryan Brotherhood, came out and dismembered a man, lynched him by tying him up with a chain to the back of a pickup truck. So it's our responsibility to be dealing with those white prisoners, with the white people on welfare, with the white workers. And to say, yes, we're not struggling about white power, we're struggling about the elimination of all exploitation and oppression. We're struggling for solidarity with the black struggle. I put out this paper, Turning the Tide. We sent it into a lot of prisons. I've had a lot of struggles with white prisoners who say, why are you always talking about this black stuff? Why do you say, end the racist death penalty? This is a man on death row, white man in Texas. On death row, he said, I'm on death row. I'm facing the death penalty. I'm white. I said, I understand that, but the reason there's a death penalty in this country has to do with racism and colonialism. Most of the other advanced capitalist countries have abolished the death penalty, not the United States. Because the death penalty was instituted in this country under the theory that the only good engine is a dead engine, and that an uppity slave has to be executed to make an example to the other slaves. And that's still why we have the death penalty in the numbers we have it. And what will save the life, although it didn't, we didn't build a movement in time to save the life of those people, but there are 3,700 people on death row in the United States. They could kill somebody every day for the next 10 years. Every day for the next 10 years, and there would still be people left now. Forget the ones they're condemning. And yet to stop that, we have to build an anti-racist movement, a consciously anti-white supremacist movement against the death penalty. It's not enough to call for a moratorium and to, you know, moan. You know, and we have to organize the families and the prisoners themselves, white prisoners, to understand this, that the way to stop the death penalty in this country is through a struggle for decolonization and real democracy and against the state. So that's what solidarity is. Spirituality, why is it there? You know, I'm not a supernaturalist. I became an atheist while I was in yeshiva. But I do believe that we have to understand that there is a spirit. It's the spirit of the people. We say the spirit of the people is greater than the man's technology. And our contributions will go on long after we're, you know, dust or our crimes, one way or the other. You know, where do we stand? And so that's about the spirit. We have to have a spirit that will uplift us, that will help us, that will sustain us, that will carry us, that will contribute emotionally and in other ways to our comrades and have a sense that, you know, we're part of a cosmic situation. There is a, you know, Martin Luther King says the arc of the universe is long, but it tends towards justice. And you have to believe that, that, you know, in fact, a system that is unjust eventually is unnatural and will topple. And that's so. We can see the evidence of it is clear because empires only survive through the constant application of repression, coercion, co-optation. This is not something that has inertia. In nature, there's inertia. If you start a rock moving in space with no friction, it will keep moving forever in the same direction. But social relations are not like that. They have to be recreated, reinforced, reproduced every day in you, and we do it. And we have to stop doing it for them and start doing it for us. It's very cheap for them to have us reinforce our own oppression. And then it's going to take struggle. That's a fact, you know. We can't do it. It's not only in our heads. There is a force out there. There are people out there who are profiting, who are benefiting, who will fight to the death to maintain this system. Their death. There are people tremendously self-sacrificing on behalf of the empire, including, you know, some of our brothers and sisters. And, you know, talk about the war between the states and the United States. There were families that were split right down the middle, people who went to war for slavery, who had no slaves. But they felt that was the God-given system they had to abide by. So it's going to take a struggle, a very fierce struggle of all kinds, all forms, and definitely involves self-defense. You know, I'm not a pacifist. I think there's a tremendous need for all kinds of cultural struggle, ideological struggle, personal struggle, transformation. But also, if you're attacked, you have the right to defend yourself. And self-criticism. And it's certainly vital for us, for anybody on the white left. You have to think about how do these things come down inside you. And again, if what we change does not change us, we're playing with blocks. If we're engaged in a struggle to change the world, if you're pointing your fingers, as we say, at you know, somebody over there, three of the fingers are pointing back at yourself, and a lot of the struggle is internal, inside ourselves. We have to be committed to struggling against racism and sexism and colonialism as we have internalized it. The class struggle is not just between the working class over here and the bourgeoisie over there. The class struggle is going on inside the working class. The struggle against white supremacy is not just against the Ku Klux Klan. It's going on inside white working people, oppressed and exploited as we may be, but identifying with those privileges. So it has to be self-critical. And then finally, social control of production and distribution. We have to build a system that does not require racism, that does not require colonialism. We have to replace what there is. We have to replace the profit motive and the idea that all of us are engaged in a mass suicidal competition. All these corporations, you know, that's what they do. They understand that as they compete, only one of them is going to be king of the mountain. One of them is left. You know, they're eating each other up alive. They're destroying each other. And they want us to do the same thing to ourselves and each other. And we have to opt out of that system, opt out of that value system, and recreate, create a different system, more harmonious to nature, not based on, you know, commodities, not based on seeing the land as a resource, the water as a resource, the air as a resource to be used for profit. So some demands, directions, decolonization. Concretely, we have to really think about that. What does it mean to decolonize this society? The most powerful empire, the most extent. And so that means, yes, independence for Puerto Rico. It means independence for Hawaii, sovereignty for Hawaii. It means sovereignty for the Native nations. It means self-determination for African people. It means reparations for the descendants of slaves. We have to concretely decolonize. We have to transform the relations, the economic, social, political relations that enforce and maintain colonialism and replace them with something else. And so white people have to be involved in the struggle for reparations. It's a hot issue in the black community. During the Democratic Convention, anybody here in California for the DNC? One or two people. But there was, you know, the same deal as they had in Philly. It was 5-6 days of activities coordinated by a network. On Tuesday, there was a black-led demonstration for reparations, big march and rally. They met at a park in the black community and marched up to downtown L.A., but you wouldn't know about it from any of the propaganda that you saw on the website of the, you know, the D2K L.A. There was a complete disconnect. You know, that should have been one of the key demands. You know, we did have a demonstration for criminal justice where we raised the demand for free all political prisoners, and that's a key one, because their ability to do these things, the reason that you are completely separated from the struggle that I was involved in the 60s and 70s, is because the state was extremely effective. The state waged a war, a domestic war. Maybe you knew about it in Argentina. You didn't know it here. COINTELPRO was a war. And they killed people. They locked people up. They drove people into exile. They drove most of the white people in my generation, you know, back into the corporate structure with that war. And so they broke the resistance. And we're dealing to this day with the defeatism that has become manifest throughout our society by that victory of the rulers and the bourgeoisie and the imperialists against the people, against the Black Panther Party, the Black Liberation Army, the Chicano struggle, the Puerto Rican independence movement. We have to regain that momentum through decolonization, demilitarization. I'm involved, and this gets into the question of community organizing a little bit. I live in a community called Culver City. It's a little small town inside Los Angeles. It's originally a little white enclave. They wanted to have a separate government so they didn't have to worry about, you know, keeping black people out. And so we've had struggles in Culver City about demilitarizing the police in Culver City. The police in Culver City get military armaments from the U.S. Defense Department. They carry big assault weapons in their police cars that they got from the DOD. The school system of Culver City spends money, a lot of money, on JROTC in the high school, junior reserve officers training corps. They want to train the kids to be, you know, soldiers in the Army. And it's not like they're getting money from the Defense Department to do that. They're spending money from the budget of the school system. So we're engaged in the struggle in Culver City against, you know, eliminate JROTC. And militarization is not just going on, you know, in the Philippines or Panama or somewhere else, you know, SOA. It's going on every city and country in the United States. The military-industrial complex did not disappear and be replaced by the prison-industrial complex. One is just supplementing the other. Direct democracy probably speaks for itself, but if you look at the elections for a minute, you know, the other issue of turning the tide we had, the headline said, abolish the Electoral College, and then Electoral College is crossed out, and it says, abolish the imperial presidency. A lot of people, you know, said, oh, this election was stolen or fraudulent, but the whole thing is a fraud. The whole thing is an electoral farce, because it's a way to maintain the empire and get you involved in building it. Decriminalization, yes, decriminalize drugs, decriminalize sex, decriminalize work, labor, all those things. Abolish the prisons and have some humane alternatives. And defense of the environment and human rights, and they go hand in hand. And, you know, we are one of the animals whose rights we have to worry about. You know, we're part of the environment. And, you know, in relation to that, again, you know, you read about Monsanto and what's going on there. They're recolonizing. They're colonizing the biosphere. They're colonizing the human genome. You know, every inch, every microscopic thing on this planet is being privatized and incorporated. And that includes, you know, cell lines and seeds and, you know, what is the Terminator seed, you know, all that stuff. They're not just terminating the seed, you know. So the thing that we need to do is have this embracing vision of where we could go and an understanding of what it is we're fighting against. And then we can begin to map out some strategies for what kinds of actions are appropriate, what kinds of tactics are appropriate, what kinds of demonstrations are appropriate, what kinds of community organizing are appropriate. If we as white people are trying to do community organizing, I think there are two areas we need to look at. One is, what are the sectors among white people where we have an opportunity, a chance to actually build a base for this kind of solidarity, this kind of radical understanding. And that's not going to be all white people. If we think that all the white people in the United States, if we just speak to them reasonably and coherently and, you know, take the nose rings out or dye our hair some other color, you know, we'll listen, forget it. It's not going to happen. Every society in history, if you have a class struggle, there's a division. And there are fairly large masses of people on the other side of that division. And don't think for a minute it's not going to be the same here. So we have to face that. We have to face that we're going to divide white people when we push these struggles forward. We're going to divide ourselves, and we're going to struggle for as many people as possible, but we're not going to win the majority of the votes and have this world come about. It's not going to happen. So we have to think who is interested right now. And obviously young people are, you know. Young people have fewer stakes, fewer ties, fewer restraints. But if you want to do this work over the long haul, you're going to have to think about multi-generational organizing. How many people here have kids currently? Anybody? Okay. Not too many. Okay. But yeah, I'm not saying there's no one, but only a few. You know, so that has to change. You know, we have to be in a movement where, the grandparents feel connected. I did a lot of work for a long time in Chicago where I worked with the Puerto Rican community. And the Puerto Rican community, very interesting community there. And you know, we can look at some of their models. We can look at some of the things the Black Panther Party did, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense at the beginning. They combined the totality of their politics in community organizing. The Black Panther Party was involved in armed self-defense. That was the name of the party. The Black Panther Party was involved in watching the cops in Oakland and other cities to prevent them from brutalizing their people. And when they watched them, you know, Huey Newton set the model, they had shotguns in hand. It was legal. And they had law books, and they were, what they said, exhausting all legal means. But those were armed means. They were an armed organization. They were not engaged in battles yet. But they were simultaneously an internationalist organization. They were simultaneously an organization carrying out the Breakfast for Children program. They were carrying out struggles in the black community about the role of the black woman in sustaining black people in this country and in trying to recognize that leadership. They were engaged in free schools in the black community, and they had a shoe factory, and they had food distribution. The Puerto Rican community in Chicago is under fierce attack by the state right now, the independentistas. There are grand juries right now that are subpoenaing people, trying to lock them up just for refusing to testify, for exerting their right to remain silent. We all know that one. You have the right to remain silent, except if they give you transactional immunity and say that they won't use what you say against you, then you lose your right to remain silent. The Puerto Ricans say, we don't care what immunity you give us. We have nothing to say to you. We're silent because that's part of our solidarity with the clandestine forces in our struggle who are fighting for independence. But those same people have a school. They've run a school in Chicago for more than 14 years, 20 years now probably, because I taught there a long time ago. They have a cultural center. They have a bakery. They have a law office. And they do that simultaneously. And they hold demonstrations. They hold Puerto Rican Day parades, you know, that bring in other sectors of the community and society. But they do that all from the same politics, which are pro-independence politics. They're politics that do not blink at the fact that armed struggle will be necessary to win the independence of Puerto Rico, as it's been necessary to win the independence of every colonized country in the world. And so that's the conundrum that I think the white left in particular has to deal with, but other lefts too. We've always had a struggle between revolution and reformism, and what gets played out is, oh, well, community work is reformist. Don't do that. But that's not the case. You can have reformism in every aspect of struggle. There's, you know, everybody here has been involved in the struggles in the globalization movement, and there are different lines in that movement about how to demonstrate, where to demonstrate, when to demonstrate, what to demonstrate about. So you can have a mass mobilization that's reformist and, you know, it's not going to change too much and just wants to make a few differences, get a seat at the table of the WTO. Or you can have a demonstration that says, stop the WTO, you know, shut it down. And that's fine. That's good. You know, those mass mobilizations are important if those mass mobilizations are part of this process of shaping a revolutionary alternative and building a sense in people of their own power, of breaking through that defeatism, of helping people understand that all of the wealth and all of the power of this system is theirs, stolen, being stolen from them right now, and that they have the power to take it back and to transform it. So if demonstrations do that, let's have more. If community work does that, let's have more. But if community work is just about, you know, getting somebody elected to the city council, forget it. If armed struggle does that, then we need some armed struggle. But if armed struggle is reformist, and there's been plenty of reformist armed struggle, you know, the United States has the most militant labor movement probably in the history of the world, carried out lots of armed struggle, dynamite, sabotage. But generally speaking, they did it for a better deal. You know, the unions that are organized now could be very, very militant, but if they're just fighting for a better deal, then that's not going to change the world. That's just going to get them a better deal for a little while, and then everything goes on merrily as before. So any form of struggle that you take up needs to keep these things in mind. It's not like, you know, one thing is going to make you pure. I was talking to somebody yesterday after the IMC workshop, the Independent Media Center. We were talking about Pacifica Radio and what happened. He was saying how disappointed he was, or how dismayed that, you know, there was an institution that was built by people, and, you know, and it was swept away, you know, after 20 years or 40 years, whatever it was. And I think it's important to understand that we need to build institutions, we need to build organizations, but that it's not like you capture that terrain and then the battle is over. It's a constant struggle inside us and inside the institutions that we create to move it forward in this direction and on this basis. And you cannot rest on your laurels. You cannot rely on the fact that, oh, I'm a revolutionary and I'm okay, you know. This is not only true for white people, but whiteness makes a big difference in all of these things, and we need to recognize that. But it does not distinguish us fundamentally, actually, from the rest of the world when you think about it. If you look at South Africa, there's a struggle in South Africa now because the African National Congress has basically adopted neoliberalism as the path to, you know, progress in South Africa. And that was an organization that, you know, was a revolutionary organization, had a long history of struggle, you know, had people martyred, carried out armed struggle, had Nelson Mandela locked, you know, away on a principal position for more than half his life. And yet, you know, that organization has lost its way. And so this is not only something cautionary for white people. This is the fact of struggle, is that we have to continue that struggle and sustain it. So let me ask some questions here and see if people want to participate in some way. I'm interested in how many people, for example, have been to a mass mobilization, let's say, more than 200 miles from their home in the last year. Raise your hand. Okay, so practically everybody here. And how many people are currently engaged in a community organizing project? Oh, quite a few. Okay, so let's hear what some of them are. Good. Just pass it around.
Both of us, we work as AmeriCorps Vistas in a low-income homeless area in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And, my project is training neighbors in the area how to film and edit footage so that they can make a video history of the area to use as an organizing tool around gentrification in downtown Grand Rapids.
We're currently working on trying to pass legislation to include farm workers in the minimum wage bill, and it's actually in Idaho. Okay.
I work with an organization which is a multiracial organization of poor and working people, and they work to build a movement to end poverty, but they also work on local, working within the community with like food. They give away food. They talk. They do a lot of work within the community as well as movement building.
I just moved, but I was working with school kids at a community garden and working on creating a community food system and working on sort of food security issues.
A few more. Anybody over here?
Yeah. I'm currently working on a master plan for Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hasn't had one for almost 40 years. And so we're trying to develop interviewing the people in our area what they want to see the city do in the next 10 years.
In West Philly, there's a free kids art class for the kids in the neighborhood after school, twice a week in the winters, and in the warmer weather, there's the Pentridge Children's Community Garden where we teach kids how to garden and stuff like that.
Okay, and there were dozens of more hands, so I think that's very good. But what I would like to do is consider, and this is not to personalize the ones that we just happened to pick out, but, you know, what do people think about those projects? How do they fit? Do they feel connected to you, to some of the other struggles you engage in about globalization, for example? Do they feel connected to understandings you have about racism or not? Or, you know, what do you think would be a better model or a better way to do it? For example, somebody said they were working for to pass legislation. Somebody was working with VISTA. Somebody else is doing community garden. Do we have some standards or some evaluations or some criteria by which we can measure what to be engaged in? Any opinions on this question? Anybody want to address that? In other words, you're spending, it's like what I say to my students, you're spending your life, you're spending your time. Is this the best way to do it? Are you getting what you want? Will it reach somewhere? I think you'd have to come forward.
I think if you're making a difference in people's lives, saying that they can organize their communities and make a difference in their lives, then that means that they can look beyond themselves and say, hey, look what I did. Maybe we can do this for the people who my habits are affecting. So while I'm not sure that organizing a community garden will solve the problem of race relations in America, it may say, hey, I can do something. I can make a difference. We did this on our own. So maybe it doesn't have to be, every project doesn't have to be the end all, but every march starts somewhere.
Yeah, you have to come forward. It won't reach that far.
My name is Mike Golash, and I'm a trade union organizer, I guess you might say, union officer and that sort of stuff. I think any struggle to improve the conditions of workers' lives is good, be it fighting to get a guy his job back, fighting to get people a place to live, fighting to get their housing improved. All those things are important, and we should engage in all those activities. But the more important issue is, what are we building out of those struggles? Are we building an organization which has the outlook of taking political power away from the people that run this country and run the rest of the world? And if in the course of the struggles that we're engaged into in a day-in-day way, we're building a multiracial organization which has the outlook of taking political power away from the capitalist class that run this world, then we're doing a good job. If we're not doing that, we're just sort of a Band-Aid solution. And we might help these people get a job back today, but someplace down the road, someone else's job is being taken away from them. So there's sort of an underlying thrust to our political movement. Are we building an organization to take power from the capitalists? And if we're doing that, good. If we're not, then we should reconsider how our work is proceeding. Thanks.
I think we have to have long and medium range planning and analyze who else is out there doing stuff in the same community and see whether what work we're doing is effective in achieving those medium and long term goals.
Yeah, I kind of want to throw something out there. Like, when we talk about these mass mobilizations, it's something to keep in mind is, how much are we alienating the people that we're fighting for because we're not including them? I mean, it's kind of like we're preaching to the choir and we're playing up to the media because we're there to, you know, basically have the, it's almost like we get together, have these big parties ourselves, and we all know what the facts are, and all we're doing is getting our message out to the media. So maybe kind of along with the same lines, you hear the phrase buy locally, maybe it should be more act locally, and that's what I hope that this workshop would be about, to really question ourselves, should we really be organizing on the same type of level with the same type of energy around around the people who live near us and the organizations that we could reach out to and empower near us, instead of putting all of our energy and all of our strength and all these websites and all these books and all this talk to, like, let's go have a party once a year at some city and raise a bunch of ruckus and break things. Let's see, where should our energy really be going?
You know, I think those are very pertinent questions, and if you read the editorial that generated this discussion, it was focused on those exact themes of the need to sink some roots where you are, to build a movement where you are with the people. But I felt it was very important to have the preliminary understanding of what are the politics to do it with. And I do want to draw this out a little further. For example, I'm a trade union organizer as well. I represent the teachers at my school in Los Angeles. I'm part of the United Teachers Los Angeles, which is a joint affiliate of the AFT and the NEA. And we're right in the middle of a struggle over our contract. We've been working without a contract since July. The union leadership just brokered a kind of a deal, and the union is now considering whether to accept or not, whether to go on strike or not. I've been involved in struggles inside the teachers' union about the questions of racism. Some of it can be dealt with by the contract, some of it not. But the teachers in Los Angeles will have to make some decisions, and the organizers within that union will have to make some decisions, and you have to have some guidelines on which to make those decisions and to do that work. And the guidelines that I have to do with racism and colonialism and the kind of education I think is valuable to have. And that's beyond the struggle over vouchers or not, or the contract or not, but it comes up. I do a lot of work around police brutality. In police brutality, this very question is a very pertinent one, because the main organizing model that's out there is the model of the October 22nd Coalition Against Police Stop Repression, Police Brutality, and the Criminalization of a Generation. And it is a mobilization model. It says, let's get everybody together once a year, even if it's in every city. That's not sufficiently local in that sense, because every city has the once-a-year mobilization. And then what happens on October 23rd? And so the question is, how can we, what are the forms of direct action? Direct action is not just a method of protest. Direct action is not just the way to have a demonstration. Direct action means that you're not protesting. Direct action means you want to replace the system that exists with something else, and right now you're taking action to do that. And so there are forms of community organizing that are direct action, that say, okay, the people are directly engaged in meeting their own needs, in educating themselves, in raising their own food, in designing their own plans, in building their own houses, whatever it takes to create a different kind of society, in helping each other through hard times, whatever it is. You know, there are a lot of different things that can do. There are certain understandings we have now about the nature of reality and society that are different from the ones that went into the organizing model that, created the Leninist Party. And those models have to do, for example, the idea of fractals, the idea of chaos, but it exists in the form of a tapestry too. If you look at a fractal, anybody know what a fractal is? Know what I'm talking about? It's a mathematical equation that creates a pattern which is infinitely self-replicating. And if you look at, but it exists in reality. If you look at Norway, if you look at the coast of Norway, to any magnification, you will see the same thing. It's like all these little bumpy, ins and outs. And if you look at it just on the map, it has these bumpy ins and outs. And if you look at it with a satellite and raise it, it has the same ones. If you look at any one of those little bumpy ins and outs, it's got the same pattern reproduced inside it down to the microscopic, submicroscopic. If you look at a that they do with the laser photography where you, a hologram. Is that right? Hologram? Is that the right word? Where anywhere you look at it, if you break off one piece of it, it's still got the whole image inside it. Our society is like that, and it's inside us. That's part of it. That's what I'm saying about the struggle is not just with the bourgeoisie. It's not just with the, the imperial army. Because the empire exists inside you. But the same thing is true in terms of this struggle. If you pull on any thread of this tapestry, you're unraveling it. So I'm not trying to tell you what piece of the work to do, but I'm telling you how to do that work, and what consciousness do you want to bring to that work, and what do you want to learn from that work, and how do you assess it? Again, it's what I tell my students. What are you getting out of it today? It's not like the future. The future is never here. It's always today. The past is gone, except that we reproduce it and live it inside us. So how are we creating this alternative power And I think it does, you know, it does involve a system of dual power. You know, if you look at the Zapatistas and other things, what was the first thing the Zapatistas did? And they did it for 10 years without anybody knowing about it. You know, eventually the Zapatistas were very media savvy, and they, you know, they had internet sites and so on and so forth. But for 10 years, neither the media nor the American left nor the Mexican government knew diddly squat about the Zapatistas, because the Zapatistas were very quietly organizing in clandestinity by listening to people. They did their consultas. They went to listen. You know, in the independent media workshop, you know, we talked a lot about media. And I think we talk about communication, but we don't understand what communication is. It's listening. You know, it's two ways, back and forth. And, you know, I think our image of media is we have two images. We have either the publicist, which is the corporate image, or the propagandist, which is the old left image. And neither of those are based on communication medium. They don't realize, well, what is the internet and all this stuff, and one-to-one and many-to-many, is that you don't have to follow those models. We can create new models out of our experience and that give people the ability to speak back and forth directly without intermediaries. You know, we need to understand how to do that. And we need to understand how to organize that way and how to bring to the community garden this consciousness and learn from the gardeners. You know, I learn from my students every day about what kind, you know, why they need to speak English, how to speak English, what English allows you to do and doesn't allow you to do, how English needs to change. English is changing as a language, you know. My students speak Spanglish. You know, it's not just a joke. They're changing the English language by the way they speak it. And so, again, if what we change does not change us, we're playing with blocks. But we have to make these judgments. We have to evaluate. You have to decide what somebody said at the beginning workshop I went to. The first one I went to was about, you know, how do we end the hegemony of pacifism or the nonviolence and so on. And the way we do that is by evaluating the effectiveness, the meaning, the content, the direction that we're moving in by our actions. And you have to do that. You know, nobody's going to do it for you. When you leave here, you have to think about, what am I going to do next? You know, how am I going to advance this process? How am I going to be engaged in a struggle that will bring this future, this anti-authoritarian, decolonized future nearer? How am I going to help topple the empire? Do people know the poem by Shelley about Ozymandias? Fairly famous poem, and people teach in literature. And, you know, basically, what does it say? It says, I came upon a ruin in the desert, you know, and it was just like a platform, a pedestal, and nothing left on the pedestal but dust and ashes. And it said, I am Ozymandias, the great and powerful, you know, tremble all you who come before me. And there was nothing there, you know. And, you know, we need to learn, one of the books I do read with my students is The Wizard of Oz. And if you read that book, it's really quite fascinating because, you know, what does Oz tell you? Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. I mean, Oz is a humbug. And the great and powerful Oz, where is all his power coming from, as I say, the message at the beginning? It's coming from you. And so the cowardly lion, you know, Oz gives the cowardly lion a medal. He says, I know many generals who are not as brave as you are, but what do they have? They have a medal. They want a medal. And so, and then the lion feels like, oh, wow, I want a medal. I must be brave. But it was the same lion, the cowardly. It doesn't, you know, being brave doesn't mean not feeling fear. All of us are cowards. All of us feel fear, and it's natural to feel fear. It's part of the human, it's part of the animal nature. You know, if you're a sentient being, you feel fear as part of your survival, but you have to understand how to overcome your fears. Did you want to speak? Sure. Yeah, you have to come a little bit further. Same thing with the scarecrow. The scarecrow is the smartest one among them, but the Oz gave him a diploma. We don't need the diplomas to be smart. You know what I mean? I'll give it to you in a second. The Tin Woodman, you know, had no heart, but he was the one who was the most emotional. Oz gave him a ticker, you know. But actually, it's in you. You have it. You have the understanding. You have the wisdom. You have the courage, you know, to make this a different world. But you have to exercise it. You have to challenge yourself.
Okay. I just kind of got here. I was here earlier, but I feel like the discussion got a little bit off track, like, since I left and came back. And I was wondering, a big problem is that this is an anti-globalization movement, and a lot of people talk about it being predominantly, you know, Caucasian, not having a lot of diversity. And no one ever talks about, like, what they're doing in their communities to solve that problem. It's always just raised, and people throw out ideological principles. And I want to know, like, what people are doing, or what suggestions do people have, like real suggestions, actual things that we can do in our communities to reach out to minority groups and really involve these people and show how global issues really do affect local communities in real ways. Thank you.
Somebody want to speak to that?
We did all-white study circles, and we broke up by gender at different points, and we broke up by different sort of, we broke up by class, but mostly it was a race sort of study group, and read some of the books that Chris Crass suggested yesterday and some other different race books and readings, and just kind of had a discussion group that was all-white people and not asking people of color to come and teach us about what our racism was.
Yeah, I think an important aspect to directly answer your question is that it's not going to be, what is going to solve this is not figuring out how to attract people of color to the anti-globalization movement. It's not going to be figuring out how we can sell, since you asked, it's not going to be figuring out how to sell, you know, our slogans or our image or our message to, you know, another constituency. It's not going to be an advertising campaign where we find another niche. No, but I think this is serious. In other words, if we want to go and seriously listen to the people who are engaged in struggles right now and learn from them about the questions you're talking about, I think that's what I'm trying to communicate. There is a black liberation struggle in this society. There is a Native American struggle going on in this society, and they are talking all the time. They're putting it out there on the internet. There is a Chicano-Mexicano struggle. There is a movement to reunify Mexico. There is an independent struggle for Puerto Rico. The Hawaiian sovereignty movement is on the web. They're out there. We have to listen to what they're saying. The women's movement, you know, is not only a white movement. The gay movement is not only a white movement. The anti-globalization movement is not, in fact, only a white movement. There are people all around the world of color who have created, you know, the U.S. and particularly the white left is quite late to that movement. That's the fact. We're not in the vanguard of it. We're not the most advanced forces in it. We have a lot to learn, to listen to from those people that are struggling. In your local communities, there's probably somebody like some of the people who have been here today, a few, you know, veterans of the black liberation struggle and some new ones who have some things to say if you want to listen. And you don't have to engage them personally to hear those things. You know, you can read the literature, as somebody said. And you can engage the struggles. In other words, if you're dealing with police brutality, if you're dealing with political prisoners, if you're dealing with you know, prison privatization and some of the other manifestations of the prison industrial complex, if you're dealing with you know, the fact that black people are being driven off the land right now, those are issues that will engage you and relate you and connect you to the people, other people who are in struggle.
Maybe my situation is different because I organize within groups, people of color. Most of the migrant farm workers are Hispanic, but we do a lot of education on, like, what are the causes of them not having a minimum wage in this country? Like, what are the historical implications of that? What parts of our economic system enable this kind of thing to happen all over the country? And also, like, what does agribusiness have to do with their situation as well? And so I don't know how that model could be applied to other different community organizing projects, but maybe just making that interconnectedness more apparent to the issues you're organizing around.
Well, I think that's right, but I think you could take those same issues out to the consumers of what those farm workers produce and raise the same issues with them about where the food comes from on our tables, you know what I mean, and what's it, what the system of agribusiness is and, you know, why the products are on the system. Yeah, and I'm sure you do. I'm just as an example, you know, to the question. Over here again.
Yeah, you've mentioned Puerto Rico independence half a dozen times this afternoon.
Puerto Rico wants independence. They do not want statehood, but they want U.S. tax dollars, food stamps, unemployment, et cetera, go down to Puerto Rico. But they want independence.
In point of fact, independence is a minority position in Puerto Rico because if you ask the Puerto Rican independent thesis, they will tell you that Puerto Rico, the question of a colonial mentality exists in Puerto Rico as well. People are hooked on the Yankee dollar. So Puerto Rico has a transformation to make of its own. I'm not talking about that. I'm saying that it's our obligation as the imperial power to get out. The reason that Puerto Ricans need food stamps is because the economy of Puerto Rico and the agriculture of Puerto Rico was destroyed by colonialism. If Puerto Rico was independent and was able to restore its pre-existing agricultural economy, they could feed all the Puerto Ricans. If they were part of a Caribbean initiative of independent nations in the Caribbean along with Cuba, they would have an industrial base that was independent of imperialism. But they don't right now. But when Germany took over Austria, I don't know if people know about this history of World War II, but they had what was called Anschluss, a unification. They said, well, all the Germans who speak German everywhere in Europe should be part of Germany. And they, marched in and took over Austria and declared it was part of Germany. And they were supposed to have a vote on whether or not to unify Austria and Germany. And the day before the Germans' army marched, only one city managed to have the vote, and they voted 97% in favor of maintaining the independence and separate existence of Austria. And then the German army marched in and took over, and then they had a plebiscite on whether Austria should be united with Germany once the German army was there, and that same town voted 95% in favor of unification with Germany. So democracy is as democracy does. If you're basing, the vote or the plebiscite or the opinion of the Puerto Ricans on an existing occupation, a military occupation, destruction of the environment, destruction of the agriculture, of the sea, of the land, of the air, then the Puerto Ricans feel weak and oppressed and don't understand that that's Puerto Rico and they have their power. So that's their struggle to grasp that all that wealth is actually their wealth and all the power is their power too. It's the same struggle we have.
Kind of going back with what the woman over here said, talking about like pedagogy of the oppressed and teaching to oppressed people about their own oppression. When speaking to a group of African-American inner-city young adults about globalization and what it meant and what these recent movements have been about, it's amazing to see how much they originally did not know, and when their eyes are opened up to the fact that they are adding to the oppression of other people who are oppressed like they feel. I think they also often feel so preoccupied with their own struggle in this country, it's hard for African Americans or other oppressed groups to donate their energy or learning about what's happening in other countries. So I think one of the first steps comes to helping them identify with those people, where I feel like there's, from a more privileged white point of view, it's almost like, well, we don't become part of the anti-globalization movement because of our identification so much as we feel like we feel ashamed of we have the guilt trip of our own privilege and we want to reach out because of that. That's kind of theory, whatever. But it all comes down to making everyone realize, like in your community organizing, that this is all part of the same machine. It's all part of the same monster. And so the more that you teach, other minority groups about the role that they play, what they buy at the store and like the politics of every action you do or what organizations you support, what media you integrate into your own ideologies, that's part of, being part of the global neighborhood and feeling like your actions affect people in other countries. And I think that's the kind of realization needed to help them make those kind of connections.
I don't want to be on a soapbox, sorry. I just wanted to address two things. Number one, about Puerto Rico. I'm Puerto Rican, and there are actually three movements, so to speak. One is that some people want independence, some people want to maintain the status quo, and some people want to become a state. That issue said. I also wanted to address bringing in minorities into globalization. A lot of times we need to remember that we have cultural differences and that the way you address issues may not be the way other minorities address issues. A lot of times within, let's say, the Latino culture, we are more thinking about the family, we're thinking about church, and we address situations differently than perhaps white middle-class America might. And so I think we need to understand those differences. And then I also wanted to point out that a lot of times maybe minorities don't understand globalization because they're struggling just to make ends meet right now in America. And how can we be thinking about countries in Israel when I'm struggling just to make ends meet? And so that's something to remember. And I think just as privileged, educated people that we are, we should just continue to educate ourselves and to be informed in what's going on around the world to address those issues.
I just wanted to say something about, I guess, I don't know, the whole minority, blah, blah, blah. But the organization I work with, they travel out of the country a lot to talk with groups of poor and homeless people and struggles all across, you know, the world. And poor and homeless organizations that are organizing now here and abroad understand is they already understand the interconnectedness. But for them, they don't think in terms of like, you know, I have to buy this kind of clothing and, you know, like that's a position of privilege when you can think, oh, well, I have to buy only union made clothing and I have to make sure that all my food is organic. They're thinking more of movement building and being in solidarity with those movements by working in their own areas. A lot of the people who have from other nations who have talked to representatives of the movement of the poor here are very happy. They want more people to mobilize here in this country because they understand that if you take it down at the power base, then it'll help their struggles abroad.
Amen. Yeah, I think that's our responsibility. That's what I said at the beginning in terms of globalization. If they're exporting the capital from here, we have to destroy capitalism and imperialism here. I just want to say one other thing again about this issue of direct action. I think we have to wrap up. Looks like people are coming in for something else. So I think in terms of the community work we're doing, I think this is very important. I want to reiterate it. Both in terms of the demonstrations and in terms of the community work, what you need to think about is what is the meaning of direct action? How can you have direct action community work? For example, around the police brutality, Cop Watch is direct action. What the Black Panthers did was direct action. They took direct action to eliminate the problem of police brutality by being on the streets with cameras and guns and law books. You know, you might do with a video camera, whatever it takes to change that problem. Not to create a civilian review board and get some people appointed by the mayor to look into it after somebody is brutalized. So if we're dealing with the problem of homelessness and hunger, then the direct action you would take is probably getting people organized to take some land back and to grow some food of their own. I think when we think about the question is how do we then engage in the struggle? And I will reiterate again, I think that especially for the white left, that has to involve listening to the voices of oppressed people who have been a struggle for a long, long time before we came on the scene and have some pretty clear ideas about, you know, what works and what doesn't and what will be effective solidarity and what won't. Thank you. I'll just say, if you want to stay in touch, the email is up there. It's part2001@USA.net, not ORG. Oh, my gosh. Okay. USA.net. Put it up wrong. How do you like that? Or www.antiracist.org/issues, HTML.